The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. So, hold on. Oh, you got no audio. Okay, now we have audio. So how was your weekend? happy Monday, everybody. What a weekend it was. I guess the big news, though, is actually being made today. You know, I thought Twitter had put in a poison pill or something so that if somebody tried a hostile takeover, shares would flood the market or something, and it wouldn't happen. And now, today, we find out that whoever is in charge over at Twitter is going to take Elon Musk's $44 billion and sell him Twitter. I mean, $44 billion? Who in their right mind would pay $44 billion for Twitter? As far as I can tell, it doesn't make a whole lot of money. I mean, I don't even know how they sell advertising. I guess they do. But $44 billion worth? Really? Poor Elon Musk. You know, he must be really stingily endowed, if you know what I mean. Because the guy is all about trying to compensate, right? Between the rockets and the cars and now the Twitter. He must have a really teeny weeny peeny. Just saying. Him and Vladimir Putin together. That's all I can figure. $44 billion? Do you know what you could do with that kind of money? You could end world hunger. You could house the homeless. You could stop climate change. You could replant the Amazon. You could feed the hungry everywhere in the world. You could inoculate everybody against COVID, although you'd have the Republicans saying, I don't want a shot. Just incredible that a man, first of all, that one man can amass this kind of fortune is obscene. And the fact that he lives in the United States and works in the United States and doesn't pay income tax. You and I promise you, pay more money in income taxes than Elon Musk does. But now, I'm on a email list and somebody just responded to my message saying Twitter's board of directors has accepted Elon Musk's offer to buy the company, putting him at the helm of a social media platform at the center of Washington debates about what content should be allowed online. And friend of the show, Dave Johnson, replied, so accounts with handles like KillJews1488 get to start trolling again. Great. Not only them, but, you know, Donald Trump will probably be tweeting again soon, too. So let me tell you, already I've seen some people on the Twitter machine inviting people to yet another platform, one that I haven't heard of, so I'm not going to promote it here. But, excuse me, I almost choked on my own breath. Let me put out just a teaser here for you. There is a new platform, a social media platform, that is all about doing good for the world, right? It's called Tribal, T-R-I-B-E-L, Tribal. It launched a year or so ago, but then they discovered a security breach. And so they went back to the drawing board and started over, and they're just about ready to launch. The timing couldn't be better. I do know the guy who is whose baby it is, and he's the real deal. He's a good guy. So, you know, let's see what happens in Twitter. It's not going to happen right away. Anyway, it's going to take a while before it clears all of the concerns. I have a feeling it's not going to go through, but $44 billion, really? Ay, just amazing. But wait, there's more. There's lots more news. So when we last met on Friday, we were watching Marge Q. Green lie her way through her bout with amnesia. She was testifying in this hearing to determine whether or not the challenges to her candidacy based on the third paragraph of the 14th Amendment, would preclude her from running for office. Because the way that amendment reads, that section of the amendment, basically, if you've ever held office, if you've sworn an oath to hold office, and you've held office, and then you participate in an insurrection, then you are prevented. You're not qualified to hold office again. Rather than me trying to explain this, and we all saw it on Friday. I mean, it was like the train wreck that you can't look away from, right? Let me share with you, before we bring John Bonifaz back on to tell us what happened and what happens next and what happened today, let me, if I can, quickly, because I had it up here just a moment ago. Here we go. Let me just share this little bit of a memory lapse of old Marge. Here's Marge Q. Green, with one of her bouts of amnesia.
Ms. Green, did you advocate to President Trump to impose martial law as a way to remain in power?
I don't recall.
So you're not denying you did it, you just don't remember.
I don't remember.
Okay. Yeah, she doesn't remember. She didn't remember anything, which prompted me to say, you know, I think maybe she should not be in Congress because this poor woman has a severe memory impairment. Maybe it's traumatic brain injury or something. I don't know. But certainly she couldn't remember anything. So I'm guessing she really doesn't have enough of her brain function to, you know, carry out the responsibilities of her office. But let's bring in an actual legal professional who will say things that you can legally say, not make up stuff like I just did. John Bonifaz, he's the co-founder and a constitutional attorney with Free Speech for People. They're at freespeechforpeople.org. They are the ones who represented the group challenging Marjorie Taylor Greene's standing, I guess, to even run for office based on her actions. Do I have that right, John?
You do, Nicole. We're cool. Proud to represent voters in her district who have filed this challenge to her eligibility to appear on the ballot based on her role in helping to facilitate the insurrection, and which means under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, she's disqualified after having taken an oath of office to defend the Constitution, then turning around and engaging in insurrection.
You know, many of us watched the hearing on Friday, thanks to the link you provided at Free Speech for People. And just the number of times she said, I don't recall, I don't remember. I know that's a legal strategy. Maybe it prevents her from being charged with perjury, because how can you prove whether someone remembers something or not? But she couldn't remember anything that she said, even though there's lots of proof that she said these things.
Just one point of clarification. She couldn't remember anything that she said when she was asked questions under cross-examination. But when her attorney got up to ask her questions on direct examination, she actually could remember a tweet that she issued the day of the insurrection, a video that she issued the day of the insurrection. She had clear memory of all that. So what that says is really goes to her credibility as a witness, that all these questions she's asked by the attorney on cross-examination, our co-counsel Andy Chelly, in asking those questions, although she couldn't recall, she couldn't remember. But, you know, when it came to her own attorney asking her question, she could remember. There was one moment early on during the cross-examination where she was asked about whether she had ever called Speaker Nancy Pelosi a traitor.
Right.
And she said her answer was no. She wasn't yet ready for her training on how to say, I don't remember, I don't remember. She blurted out no. And then, you know, our co-counsel Andy Chelly said, well, let's go to this exhibit. And then it dawned
all of
on
a sudden, she said, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, now I kind of remember.
And once she tripped over that wire, you know, then she got on the train of, I don't remember, I don't recall. It's just not believable.
No.
It's incredibly evasive.
For anybody who didn't hear it, let me just play a quick segment. Yeah. I played the one because new texts were were released today that proved that one. She definitely did call for martial law, but she spelled it M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, but that's besides the point. No one ever accused Marjorie Taylor Greene of being a brain surgeon. Anyway, listen. Just listen to this. If you didn't see any of the hearing, this is all you need to hear.
Any of them?
I do not remember.
Not any of them?
No.
Okay. And you spoke to some people about those demonstrations prior to being sworn in as a representative from the 14th District, right?
I don't remember.
She doesn't remember.
And you spoke to some of those people after you took the oath on January 3rd and before the 6th, right?
I don't remember.
I just don't remember. Yeah.
Did you speak to anybody in government about the fact that there were going to be demonstrations in Washington on January 6th?
Don't remember.
I don't remember. We were mostly reading information about election fraud and people signing affidavits about what they'd witnessed with voter fraud and preparing to object. That was
That's what she remembers.
Right.
She doesn't remember anything
your testimony
else.
As you sit here today under oath is that you didn't talk to anybody in government about the fact that there were going to be large protests in Washington on January 6th.
Of course not.
I don't remember.
Don't remember. You know, that's enough. It goes on for about another minute, just like that. And that wasn't edited. That wasn't even a thing right. strung together of her saying. Now, obviously, I know people are often coached to say that when you don't want to answer a question. But isn't that perjury in and of itself?
Well, there are cases that can be brought when someone is intentionally being evasive and basically engaging in that kind of conduct in a courtroom. The question here for us is really whether or not this witness can be deemed as credible by the administrative law judge who has to weigh the evidence, both in terms of what we've already presented of her statements, her tweets, her videos that she issued saying there shouldn't be a peaceful transfer of power,
right,
which is critical to demonstrating her engagement in the insurrection, and weighing that against her testimony. And in our view, there is overwhelming evidence that we've presented that she engaged in insurrection and that her answers simply do not help her in any way to negate that. So this is now up to the state administrative law judge. There's a post-trial brief that will be filed by both sides this coming Friday.
Okay.
We will then have some time to review that and make a decision. His decision will be a recommendation to the Secretary of State of Georgia as to whether or not she should be kept on the ballot. And then the Secretary of State of Georgia will need to decide whether to accept or reject that recommendation. Then either side can appeal it into the Georgia courts. But what's significant here, Nicole, is that we know that Marjorie Taylor Greene, through her attorneys, fought every step of the way to prevent last Friday's hearing from even happening. They rushed into federal court. They made a ton of different arguments, you know, throwing the kitchen sink at this to argue why this hearing shouldn't happen. They lost on every count with respect to their motion for a preliminary injunction before Judge Amy Tobin. She issued a 73-page ruling demonstrating why they were not likely to succeed on their on the merits of their claims and why she was not going to issue a preliminary injunction. And so she had to show up at that point, and testify. But, you know, I think that's significant because we know this was not something she willingly was ready to do. She fought it until it was no longer possible to not show up. And I think now we know, based on her testimony, how incredibly evasive she was. And that will reverberate for days and weeks to come as more and more evidence comes out
right.
demonstrating what she actually knew.
And more evidence does keep coming out. So yeah. I've got some questions about where these texts have been for the last year and a half. Someone kept them under wraps. So before Friday, you know, one of the first question that I played when you came on was her saying she couldn't remember whether or not she had ever suggested that we need martial law to, you know, to prevent Biden from taking office and everything to go on. And she couldn't recall. Well, today, another 2,300 texts were released to and from Mark Meadows between Election Day and January 6th. And one of the last messages included in that log is from Marjorie Taylor Greene to Mark Meadows on January 17th. And she said, quote,
3 days before Biden was to be inaugurated.
Three days before. And she said, in our private chat with only members, which raises another whole area of questioning here, several are saying the only way to save our republic is for Trump to call for martial law. I don't know on those things. I just wanted you to tell him. They stole this election. We all know they will destroy our country next. Please tell him to declassify as much as possible so we can go after Biden and anyone else. Okay, so she did call on him to invoke martial law, even though she doesn't understand what it is, obviously. But on the stand, she said she couldn't recall whether or not she advocated for that. But we're learning more and more from these more texts that keep getting released. Obviously, she was involved. She did call for martial law. This has to have some impact. But so you went through this whole hearing, hours of testimony. Now you have to file another motion. And when the judge does weigh in, it's just a recommendation. And the Georgia Secretary of State, who is running for re-election after being, you know, ridiculed by Trump for the last couple of years, he gets to make that decision, and he's running as a Republican.
He does in the initial stage, but then, as I said, there's a opportunity to go into the courts on this. But I think on the martial law point, I mean, it's just, as we know, not believable that you would somehow not remember advocating to the White House that martial law be imposed on the American people to keep that current president in power. That kind of conversation or exchange, you would remember that. It's just not believable. But the other point on this is she was asked directly, Nicole, in follow-up questions on that point, whether she had any communication with the White House chief of staff, who was Mark Meadows. And she said, I don't remember. Whether she had any communications with anyone in the White House on this question, she said, I don't remember. So she was given multiple chances to remember whether, in fact, she had had any of those kinds of conversations. And she said, I don't remember all of them. And that's where I don't think it's credible. And that's why I think the judge needs to take that into account. The reason why I highlighted January 17th is the fact that we're dealing with the insurrection already having happened, right? We're dealing with 11,
after January 6th, right?
Yeah, we're dealing 11 days later, and the inauguration is about to happen. And she said she didn't want any, she's all about peacefulness and everybody, you know, no violence. She never promotes violence. And there she is 3 days before the inauguration of then President-elect Biden arguing that there should be martial law imposed on the American people. It's extraordinary.
It really, really is. Now, so this will probably go on for a while, because depending on the recommendation from the judge, then whatever Brad Raffensperger does, and then how all the parties respond. So this could drag on for a while. There was a hearing in Arizona in the last few days, too, wasn't there? Or was there?
Well, what happened in Arizona is we had a hearing on motions to dismiss that the defendants in those cases filed. Congressman Paul Gosar, Congressman Andy Biggs, and Mark Fincham, who's a state representative running for Arizona Secretary of State. They were all the defendants in these cases brought by voters whom we represent in Arizona, challenging their eligibility to appear on the ballot in Arizona based on this insurrectionist disqualification clause, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Right. The judge in that case held a hearing last Wednesday on the motion to dismiss that each of those defendants had filed. He found two things in agreeing with their motion. Number one, he found there was no private right of action for voters in Arizona to challenge the eligibility of candidates on this basis. So what he's saying essentially is they can challenge them on the basis of age qualifications or residency qualifications. But on this question, there's no private right of action. And that doesn't really make any sense.
No.
Why the Constitution of the United States, which provides a qualification, you know, just like the age and residency qualifications are there, why somehow Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not a qualification for which there's a private right of action under the state law that allows for these challenges. The second thing he argued is that the qualifications clause of the Constitution, which establishes the Congress as the power to decide who gets seated in the U.S. Congress, that that means that only Congress can decide who gets on a state ballot. Under that definition of his ruling, a 14-year-old can now run for Congress in Arizona, and the state has no authority whatsoever to keep that person off the ballot. A foreign national, Vladimir Putin, could run for Congress in Arizona, and based on his reasoning, under the qualifications clause, the state has no authority whatsoever to knock that person off the ballot. That's just not at all what the qualifications clause is about. And we're appealing this ruling to the state Supreme Court. And we expect there to be an expedited hearing on it. But we don't believe that either of his counts for dismissing this case are accurate under the law.
I see. There's the third case that you guys are involved with, too, and that's in North Carolina with Madison Cawthorn. That the expedited hearing is coming up May 3rd. In the meantime, there have been other things that have come to light with Madison Cawthorn. It blows my mind that anybody voted for this man. And I know who his opponent was, a guy named Colonel Mo Davis, who was a great candidate who was military. I mean, he was a moderate Democrat. There was no reason he would have been the perfect representative for that district who could represent everybody. Instead, they got this clown who I even if he is allowed to run, I don't think he could ever win again, because people are starting to see who he is. So what do you guys do now? You prepare for the next step in this fight?
That May 3rd hearing is actually an oral argument before the U.S. Court of Appeals.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Fourth Circuit. And what's at stake there is the question of whether the judge's ruling at the federal district court level, which blocked that hearing altogether. So unlike in Atlanta, where we had a hearing because a federal judge recognized there was no basis to block it from going forward. Mm-hmm. This particular judge, a Trump appointee in North Carolina, decided that an 1872 amnesty law providing amnesty to ex-Confederates applied to Madison Cawthorn as well, 150 years later. Wow. There's no constitutional scholar we've identified anywhere in the country who believes that's anything but absurd. And we're appealing that ruling. And that's what's at stake with that case. And May 3rd is when that panel of appellate judges will hear the argument. And we're hopeful that that ruling will be reversed and that the hearing before the State Board of Elections on Madison Cawthorn will proceed. But the big picture here, Nicole, beyond these legal challenges, is that election officials all across the country have the mandate to follow Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, what it's requiring, and to determine if anyone is on their ballot who's previously taken an oath of office to defend our Constitution and then engages in insurrection, including mm-hmm. the January 6th insurrection. And that includes, going into the 2024 cycle, Donald Trump. So we're quite clear at Free Speech for People that should he decide he's going to run again, we will be filing these challenges against Donald Trump's eligibility. And, when he said the other day that poor Marjorie Taylor Greene was being put through hell, well, he needs to understand that predicament, because he will face a challenge. And in Georgia, there's a precedent now for putting him under oath and having a hearing on his qualifications based on the fact that he's the inciter in chief. He incited an insurrection and is disqualified under the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, the former guy, he's got some things happening now. He's experiencing some things, because just today, a judge in New York State found him in contempt because he didn't comply with the subpoenas to turn over information to the New York Attorney General's office. So the judge sided with Letitia James, and he will now, I guess, starting tomorrow when the papers are filed, be fined $10,000 a day until he complies with the subpoena. It's interesting that Congress doesn't have those enforcement powers that the courts do, because they're ignoring congressional subpoenas. But this is what happens when you don't comply with a state subpoena.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite significant that we see this particular order getting issued by a New York state judge. But it does really highlight, separate in part from Congress, Where is the Department of Justice? Why is it that this is the first such order against Donald Trump, and it's coming from a state judge in this kind of proceeding, which is a civil investigation, not a criminal investigation by the state attorney general? You know, I understand people think that somehow any day now he's going to unveil some broad indictment. But frankly, I see no indication that Merrick Garland is engaged in the broad scale investigation that's necessary of Donald Trump and his associates for all federal crimes that they committed during the past administration and going into this year as well. I just think it's incredible that we haven't had that accountability. And one of the reasons why there was such a hunger for people to watch the hearing last Friday is because for the first time, a member of Congress who's part of the insurrection crowd is being held accountable.
The first one, first time any member of Congress.
Any of those insurrectionists were under oath at the highest level. I know we've got a lot of trials happening with the low-level insurrectionists that stormed the Capitol, but the high-level officials who took these oaths of office to defend the Constitution, this was the first time. And, you know, I'm happy that we played a role there at Free Speech for People, but it really shouldn't be up to individual voters and a nonprofit organization to have to hold these members of Congress accountable. We should have the Department of Justice doing its job and holding these members of Congress accountable and holding Donald Trump accountable. And so far, we haven't seen that. And that's, I think, very disconcerting.
I do, too. Now, I know Joe Biden is trying to show he's the opposite of Donald Trump, that he doesn't consider the attorney general his personal attorney. And so he's taken a hands-off approach. Isn't there some middle ground where he could say, look, you are the lawyer for the country. Do your job.
Well, I think we've got what's going on is a reverse situation on the politics side, which is, you know, we saw Bill Barr being treated as the private attorney for Donald Trump. Now, unfortunately, I think what we have is Merrick Garland saying, I'm not going to get involved in prosecuting the former president because that would seem too political.
Oh, gosh.
That, by definition, is a political decision.
Exactly.
It's a political. You don't factor that in to whether or not you prosecute someone. The factoring in is solely on whether the facts and the law lead you to engage in that kind of prosecution. External questions about maybe this is going to invoke a civil war. Maybe, in fact, you know, this is going to be bad for the political agenda of the president's administration.
Then he shouldn't be right. He shouldn't be considering any of that. It's not that's not his lane.
And until we see some kind of action out of the Department of Justice, that's the only conclusion that can be drawn as to why a year and a half later, after the insurrection, we have seen no accountability. So that I think has to be part of the overall picture on this in terms of why the Department of Justice needs to be pressed to do its duty.
Gotcha. John Bonifaz, thank you so much for explaining all this to us. We've obviously got a long way to go and a lot of work to be done, miles to go before we sleep, if we ever do again. I so appreciate your work on this. Please keep us posted. And so everyone can follow along at freespeechforpeople.org. You can follow you on Twitter at John Bonifaz. I'll put all the info on the blog where I post today's show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole. Great to be with you.
You as well.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. So John Bonifaz, again, there's a lot of work still to be done, but they are doing it. So I'm rushing because I have an interview to share with you. And after the show, I need to bolt right at 6 o'clock Eastern because I'm going to go on Progressive Democrats of America's YouTube channel along with Harvey Wasserman and Nina Turner and I believe Mimi Kennedy and Alan Minsky and a few other people talking about the problems in Ohio and Florida. So you can, again, go to the Progressive Democrats of America YouTube page at 6 o'clock Eastern. Right when we end, I'm going to jump over there. So I want to let you know. Now, I have a guest coming up. Before I get to this, I want to let you know, I heard from Tanya again this morning, and she said, I'm completely horrified because, and I think there was a breakdown in communication here. She said, a referendum has been scheduled for my birthday on May 1st. I don't know what referendum she's referring to, but she's talking about the city of Kherson in Ukraine, which is where she's from, that is now being attacked by Putin and company. And she said, My aunt remained in my city because she has three dogs and two cats, and she is not a traitor. And so she said, and also people are not released. They allowed 200 to 300 cars to leave the city for 5 days, told everyone else no, turned the muzzle of the tank on them, and sent them back to the city. They said that only pregnant women can leave, and those who are very sick are not safe for everyone else. So now she's distressed because the place where she was raised is under attack. Her aunt is stuck there, and it looks like they're pulling the same nonsense that they've been doing in other regions. Mariupol is still not under Russian control because those people are just fighting back with everything in them. But so this brings me to our guest today. And I'm just going to introduce him because I can, and let you hear the rest for yourself. Take it away, power of videotape. Blattman joins me now. He's the author of a new book called Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. And Chris, you actually, this is what you do for a living. You are the professor of global conflict studies at the University of Chicago. So you deal with war. This is the subject that you teach regularly, huh?
Yeah. And I, you know, a lot of my day job is not so much war at this level of nations, but this war at the level of city gangs, whether it's here in Chicago, whether it's in Colombia. A lot of my career, I also worked in rebel groups in East and West Africa. And so, but, you know, the same principles apply.
Now, a book takes, there's a long lead time. So you, when you wrote this, and even when they set the publication date, probably had no idea that there would be this major war waged by Russia against Ukraine. It was just timing.
Just, yeah, none whatsoever. And you know, yeah, it's the kind of book where you don't want to be relevant.
Right. So here we are, though. And, you know, I'm about as anti-war as is possible. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. I've been, you know, I still remember the poster, "War is not healthy for children and other living things," that I trot out every once in a while here. And people, young people go, "Oh, that's a cool poster." It's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we grew up with it during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So I you know, I never thought we would see a war like this again, frankly, a ground war where people are being just killed. And the atrocities we're seeing happening in Ukraine are just unimaginable. Did you expect that there would be another ground war like this in our lifetime?
So, you know, yes. However, the one of the overarching messages of the book is, you know, a lot of people think war is easy and peace is hard. War is actually really hard, and peace is easier than we think. And the reason is because it's just so ruinous, yeah. Right? That's why most adversaries basically try to find some other way. And you know, and we pay attention to the conflicts. A lot of people, you know, we pay attention to the conflicts happening. We have to, right? Because you have to stop them. But, you know, 2 weeks into the invasion, India accidentally lobbed a cruise missile at Pakistan and common suit. Because fighting would have been unimaginably costly. And indeed, they've had this disputed territory of Kashmir for decades, and they haven't gone to large-scale war. And so that's the norm. Likewise, we kids in the U.S. are going to learn about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan for the next two generations, if not more. Mm-hmm. No one's going to learn about the 1994 U.S. invasion of Haiti, when Colin Powell went over and he went to the dictator who had seized power, and he showed him a video of U.S. troops taking off. And he said, listen, that isn't happening now. That took place 2 hours ago. They're almost here. And that dictator surrendered, and he handed back power to a democratically elected government. Wow. And these moments of quiet compromise, which are the norm, slip from memory, and we pay attention to the conflicts that did happen. And we have to, but we, like a doctor who would only focus on the sick and forget that humans are healthy, we can't make that mistake.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that the book is titled Why We Fight. And right. That's a question that maybe it's part of it is that I'm a woman. Part of it is that I grew up, you know, as a kid in the 60s. But it's so barbaric, just the the act of war. I've always had the notion that if women ruled the world, there would be a whole lot less war. And I look at, you know, I've been in touch with a woman from Kyiv. I have a habit of calling to places around the world where there's stuff happening just to talk on a human level to people. And I met this woman who owns a hostel in the middle of Kyiv. She's married. Her husband stayed, but he talked her into leaving. She went to Poland and now she's in Dubai with her sister. But I'm listening to her daily, you know, we communicate over the Telegram app, and, you know, her daily heartache over what's happening to her country, and seeing these are atrocities, and atrocities happen in war. But we're hearing about these Russian soldiers just killing people haphazardly, leaving bodies on the street, and raping children in front of their mothers. I mean, it is insane. And it's, do these people even know why they're fighting?
So I think, you know, it just goes to say this is why it's rare and why you were right in some ways not to expect this, because it's so costly. It's also costly for the Russian side. Yeah. Now, not everyone, right? And that's crucial, right? Because there's a really simple answer to why we fight. And it's because somebody ignored those costs, or somebody had a reason to pursue it because, you know, in spite of the costs. And in the book is actually about how it seems like there's a reason for every war and war for every reason. But in fact, there's really just kind of five ways that societies or their leaders overlook those costs. And that's why we fight. And we get to peace by making them accountable for those costs.
Okay, so you do break it down into five reasons for war. These are obviously generalizations, but throughout history, one of these five or a combination of them apply in each instance?
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, a lot of my day job is on street violence in the United States or Latin America, or rebel violence in Africa, and it applies at that level too. So here it is. So why do we overlook the costs? Well, first of all, the first one's unchecked leaders. Mm-hmm. So think about Putin, right? He's a personalist autocrat. He doesn't bear most of these costs. Right. He doesn't have to consider them because he's not accountable. That's number one. Number two, intangible ideological incentives, right? When we hear about his nationalist ambitions or his desires for personal glory in a place in history, he's willing to pay the costs for some ethereal or ideological goal and gain that he gets. Okay. The third, uncertainty. You know, it's so hard to remember just how uncertain some of these things were beforehand, how plucky and resolved were the Ukrainians, how resolved the West would be on sanctions, and just the performance of the Russian military, to which everybody, especially Putin, is surprised. And when things are this uncertain, you can underestimate the costs, right? Very easily. And you can essentially, war is a gamble on your best guess. Then there's something, the fourth one I call misperceptions. So yes, the world's uncertain, but sometimes we also, you know, we look at it in a biased way. And every time you hear a tale of Putin being isolated and overestimating his chances, underestimating the costs, that's a misperception amidst uncertainty that leads him to actually go to war despite the costs. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is a strategic concept known as a commitment problem. And it's when you can't trust your enemy to, you know, basically to commit to a deal. And so you lock in your advantage now while you can. And so Russia was looking at Ukraine in early this year, and they were acquiring Turkish drones. They were building these Neptune missiles we've learned so much about when they sank this cruiser. Mm-hmm. They are maybe going to get long-range missiles from themselves or the West at some point, and they can't commit not to do that. Secondly, they're getting closer to democracy. They're not going to roll back their freedoms. That was kind of unimaginable. And so Russia was at its peak leverage. And so it's time to lock in that advantage. So it's cruel and it's calculating, right? And it's evil, but it's a logical and reason to ignore the costs. And so like all these other five, it's a reason that Putin either ignores the costs or has some other incentive to overlook them.
Right. So when misperceptions also might be, so Putin, you know, has this belief that they are all powerful and the rest of the world will fall at their feet. And he thought they'd go in and invade, and within 72 hours, Kyiv would fall. And that didn't happen. And now here we are in month two, coming up on, you know, going into the third month. And I guess he misunderestimated the resolve of the Ukrainian people. Right. And so now we're hearing that he's telling, it was the president of Austria or somewhere, that that he believes that they're winning. Is that just posturing, or does he really believe it? Because there are some who say that, much like Trump before him over here, he's not getting the truth from his minions. They're telling him what he wants to hear.
Yeah. So sometimes that happens, and especially in the lead up to war, eventually these things are hard to overlook and even hide. So I think we have to take these seriously. And it was a big reason for the invasion. The fact is those misperceptions are probably mostly dissipated now, and a lot of the uncertainty is gone. And so maybe that wasn't the only reason because they're still fighting, right? So maybe there's something more strategic at work here in addition, because I think there's just this classic problem. We have to be careful not to demonize our enemies. We have to do something. We have to have strategic empathy, which means we have to understand our adversary better and not make our own misperceptions in order to stop the fighting and to win. And so I think there were misperceptions. There may still be, but I think we shouldn't turn away from some of these other more strategic logics that I will outline, because that might be why he's still fighting.
It's hard to get into his head, especially with a man like Vladimir Putin. And you don't know, there's speculation on so many fronts. One, he's suffering from some deadly disease, and he wants his legacy, and he wants to, put the band back together again and reform the Soviet Union. And he wants the ports. He wants access to the Black Sea. And that's why he's now doing this Eastern thing. We don't know, but we do know that Vladimir Zelensky is not the guy that they thought he was going to be. I mean, when he said in the earliest days of the war, "I don't need a ride, I need ammunition," that was a surprise to most people, wasn't it?
It was, and I think it goes back to this idea that for all the misperceptions, there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty. Like, lots of experts, I know a lot of military experts, I know a lot of Russia experts, and this sequence of events where the West was this unified, the Ukrainians were this plucky, Zelensky was this effective and resolved, and the Russians were this inept militarily, caught. That combination was not something most people predicted, including Putin. And so this environment of uncertainty is what makes the world still dangerous.
Right. Now, Chris Blattman, you are, in addition to a professor of global conflict, you also, you lead the development economics group. So you deal with economics as well. This is a war is a huge cost. I'm not even talking in terms of life, but in terms of treasure, in terms of money. Russia wasn't that great economically anyway. This has to be really breaking them, isn't it?
It surely is. It's, I think, the reason we should hope for a stalemate, if not some kind of settlement. The fact is, as I said, listen, most of the time wars don't happen.
Yeah.
And when they do happen, most of the time wars are short. And so, and we don't remember that because we do pay attention to the long wars, right? We ought to, for some reason.
And we're coming off of Afghanistan with 20 years, which is a lot of the kids now know. They never lived in a world without us being at war.
Exactly. So, but most wars are short. And they end in settlements or stalemates, often bitter ones that neither side really wants to accept, but war is so brutal. And Putin built his popularity and his hold on power through the economic success of Russia. It surged forward economically from 2000 to 2015. It's kind of stagnated since then. If this is going to hurt him and his hold on power. And so he has his incentives to keep fighting, but that's a really powerful counterforce.
So now we're here. The latest reports I heard like last night and this morning were that some of his allies inside the Kremlin are finally starting to say, enough already. This is madness. This has to stop. Do you know enough about the power structure in Russia right now to see if anyone can have influence over him, or if he's just some mad dictator who everyone is too afraid, I think, as they were with Trump, to tell him, no, you're wrong?
So I'm not going to pretend to be the expert on Russia. I sit next to some colleagues who are amazing, either Russian or experts. It might be happening. It should be happening. There is always some counselor whispering in the monarch's ear, peace, sire, it is too expensive. There is not enough money in the treasury. So that is universal. And that's why they don't fight, or why they don't fight for long. So I guess I'd be surprised if that didn't happen. But one of the, and this isn't just true of Russia, one of the logics of autocracy is you have to protect yourselves from coups. And And so you're constantly, everything you do outwardly is designed to keep you in power inwardly. And sometimes that means keeping anybody with good sense or capability far away from you and or disempowering them. And so you can end up with a circle of yes men. Mm-hmm. U.S. presidents sometimes end up in this situation as well, to a lesser extent, but one that's dangerous for us all. And so it's true for any leader. It's especially true for a personalized autocrat.
You know, I'm going to get back to the wrap up, basically, because you talk about why we fight, but then you also talk about the paths to peace. But before we get there, Chris Blattman, you talked about, you know, in your teaching, in your day job, you talk about gang violence and things like that. I wonder the attitudes, the mood of this nation right now, and I know it's not unique just in the United States. I think it's happening all over the world. A few things we're seeing, sort of a nod towards authoritarianism, like the for whatever reason, attitudes. I live in Florida, and we have a governor who's putting all of these insane, to my ears, laws in effect that are frightening, and people are going at one another. You know, with this judge who overturned the mask ruling the other day, we have a candidate for a Democrat who's running to unseat DeSantis, who came out the other day and did a video from a plane. She's like, well, you know, mask is over, we got to get on with our lives. And and the backlash, and I called her out on it. Look, I'm a lung cancer survivor. I have one good lung, so I'm very careful out in public, and I always wear a mask. And then I look at parents of kids who are five and younger, and they can't get vaccinated, and people who have immune issues. I think it's very selfish. And so Nikki Fried, I think, did herself a real disservice. And I posted, I said something about it on social media. The attacks on my character, because I dared to say, to criticize her action and this judge, are just, it's not political discourse. It's angry, ugly, personal ad hominem attacks. I mean, and we're seeing that more and more. I just saw something in passing. Mike Tyson beat someone up on an airplane who I guess gave him a hard time, maybe about a mask. I'm not sure. But we're seeing more and more of this. Tempers are rising. Do you see this as part of, does this play into your five reasons theory as well?
People are worried about the polarization in America and all these debates. They're also worried about it turning into violence, not just because someone beat someone up on an airplane, but because there's another riot or violent riot, maybe a more planned and organized riot, increased extremist violence. And people have been saying, are we going to go down the path of Northern Ireland? Right. That's the that's a highly unlikely, but that's a dire scenario. And so what do we have to say about that? Well, maybe the hopeful message is that enemies prefer to loathe in peace. That's what we learn from this book, from all this type of conflict, that war and fighting, the violence is so costly that we might be at each other's throats. We might be angry. It might be bitter and polarized, but it will probably be peaceful because nobody really wants to go towards violence. Now, it would be nicer if we could be less polarized, if there were more interrelationships, if there was more, you know, if we weren't so bifurcated in some ways as a nation. We don't need that for peace, at least in the sense of not being violent and not fighting violently. You can be totally self-interested and loathe your enemy, and you still have a huge incentive to keep it violent. Now, I hope for more, but I take some, you know, I take what I can get sometimes.
You know, what scares me, one of many things that scare me these days, is that during the early days of the pandemic, especially, but throughout, people bought guns. The sale, there are many more guns than there are citizens in the United States. And unfortunately, I don't have the empirical evidence to back this up, but I think most of the guns are on the other side of the political spectrum from where I sit. And that's frightening because they're the ones who are screaming Second Amendment remedies. That's scary. That's threatening, taking it right up to the edge. And then we have a political party who's being led by somebody I consider sort of the equivalent of Putin over here, who, you know, freaked me out when he had access to the nuclear button. So, I think we're living on the edge, and maybe that's why the temperatures are rising so much.
So This is a good, great way to sort of see the difference between individual and group violence. And so violence on a small and a large scale, more guns and more people's hands, given that we're like a hot reactive species sometimes, means I think maybe more interpersonal violence within families, between households, between gangs, whatever it will be. But do I think it means the possibility of group like more aggregated violence, other than the accumulation of all these terrible deaths, which is, I don't want to diminish that, but think about the way to think about it is, I said war is costly. That's our incentive for peace. The more both sides arm, here's the sad truth, the more both sides arm, the more costly is a all-out fight. Yeah. And so the more strenuously you try to avoid it. And so I don't want to pretend that that's like our path to peace is arming each other more, because if something slips, it's going to be a doozy.
Yeah.
But I want to at least stress that I don't think this is helping us march towards another civil war, which I don't think will happen, but I do think it could be bad news for this everyday interpersonal violence.
Oh, without a doubt. And it makes life even more stressful. All right. Yeah. So Chris Blattman, again, the book is Why We Fight, The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. So the second part of it is the paths to peace. How do we get to peace, both in Russia and Ukraine, especially because my heart breaks for the people there every day. I don't know how they're surviving, and many of them aren't. So how did they get to peace?
So, you know, in the book, I talk about different paths. What every path to peace has in common is it figures out why, in Putin's case, he's ignoring the costs of war and trying to address one of those five reasons, whichever we think is more relevant. When I do my work in Chicago or Medellin or West Africa, it's taking the right diagnosis, figuring out which of the five are operating there, and then trying to find the right solution. So I don't want to pretend like there's a one size fits all solution, but the things that are common over and over and over again, let me give one example, are like predictable rules and enforcement, right? And so our sanctions regime is in some ways, it probably wasn't as predictable as it could or should have been, but once in place, it's a serious disincentive to a unchecked leader pursuing intangible incentives. It's the West saying, we understand that you're not checked, that you have your own reasons for fighting. We're going to give you a counter incentive. Now, it turns out not to have been enough, but it was enough to deter him probably. Think of all the nasty things he could have done for the last 20 years, right? So I mean, he was deterred from a lot. So is the next state dictator and the next one after that. So having a predictable regime of punishments, I think is the right way to go. This, by the way, is how Latin American governments are countering cartel violence, and even how U.S. cities approach gang violence. So the police or the government, they go to these armed groups and they say, look, bodies are dropping. If bodies drop in your neighborhood, whether that's some Mexican state or a neighborhood of Chicago, we're going to basically come after the leadership. And that's, you know, it's not a magic solution to violence, but the cities that have done this effectively and that at least face organized gangs can take the same sort of sanctions-like approach. And I think it does, it's an example of what gets us on the path to peace. It's forcing them to internalize the costs that they ignore.
So, you know, the other part that I think about along these lines is the people in Russia are many living in poverty. I mean, you got the oligarchs who are high on the hog, but the general population is not living in the lap of luxury. They're struggling. And now he's bombing Ukraine into oblivion. If he does win and Ukraine becomes part of Russia, he can't afford, he can't rebuild that nation as it is. Many billions of dollars in damage. I'm sure we've all seen the burned out cities that are completely obliterated. Why? I mean, I don't get, other than the Black Sea, the ports, I don't get why he wants this. Is it just megalomania? Is it just the...
Well, I think you kind of like put it really perfectly. Like there's a pie. We can split it peacefully or we can destroy half of that pie and then one of us gets it. And I can always get a share of the pie through my negotiation that I couldn't, that a better share than before. Now we have to split a destroyed pie.
Right.
And that's why most of the time we don't fight. And so he did ignore this uncheckedness, his intangible incentives, the uncertainty, all these sorts of things led him to sort of overlook that irrationally a little bit, but also rationally. And the best that can be said is that it's fortunately the exception rather than the rule, because for 20 years, he tried to do everything short of invasion. Right? He tried everything. He dark money, propaganda, assassinations, supporting separatist groups, etc. It was his last resort, and he never had to do it. I mean, look at all of Russia's other neighbors. They've subjugated Belarus. There's quote-unquote peacekeepers in Kazakhstan. You know, it's peacefully managed to throw its weight around as it's grown more powerful, as all great powers do. And the best, it's not just and it's not equal, but it wasn't violent. And except in this case, and it's in a, the exceptions are important, but the exceptions are not the rule.
You know, Kazakhstan's a great example. And I'm aware of Kazakhstan because I was there 20 years ago. I adopted my daughter from Kazakhstan. So that, you know, my like lights up when I see stuff going on there. And it was violent for a couple of days. And then it, and now, you know, it's always been a puppet government there for Putin. Yeah. They were always aligned with the Russians. And so now if Ukraine were to fall and, you know, I could see, so Putin can reassemble. He's got Belarus, he's got Kazakhstan and Ukraine and Russia. There's the start of reconstituting the Soviet Union. Thus, he can, I guess, die thinking, well, I restored it to its former glory because I think that's how his mind works, but we don't really know. But that is an example of what you're saying. The little conflict in Kazakhstan was over very quickly. It was horrendous and terrifying because I looked at streets where I walked, you know, under with gunfire. So, you know, and then you think of all the people that live there. So if President Zelensky called you and said, Chris Blattman, I read your book, what advice do you have for me? What would you say to him?
You know, the reason that's a tricky answer is because let's think of what you just mentioned, Kazakhstan. Like, they decided for whatever reason not to put up a fight. Like, they faced an infinitely more powerful enemy, and they did what most people have done in history, which is they gave up. And it was cruel and unjust, but it was peaceful because it's anything else was too costly. And so the Ukrainians said, no way. This is, I think, why Americans sort of, it resonates so much. This is exactly the same as the American Revolution, right? A tyrannical superpower said, you are just strong enough to get semi-sovereignty. You don't deserve freedom. We're not going to give it to you. And they couldn't probably win a war. It wasn't the likely outcome, but they said, no way, we will fight. And so the Ukraine, so that's what Ukraine said, no way. And I don't know what I want to call it, Zelensky, anywhere that I want to call up, you know, George Washington and say, you know what, maybe the sensible thing would have just to sort of let the tanks roll over you and flee and then people won't die, right? Because I think Ukrainians, fundamentally, they face a strong adversary. Ukrainians have made a choice to fight no matter what. And I just think we have to support them in that and without escalating to a world war. But when they're ready to settle and Zelensky is seeking a settlement, right? We have to make sure that our craziness and our hatred and our loathing of Putin and our desire to see him punished doesn't stand in the way.
Right.
Of that.
Right. Well, me as a, you know, human being who hates war and is, you know, just shocked by the news we're seeing, my reaction is someone got to go take out Putin. Obviously, I'm not a military strategist or anything. How do you think
we
Joe Biden
been
is
good at that? If I thought there was an easy way to get rid of the world's worst personalized autocrats, I might ignore the costs of fighting and say we as a society ought to do this for that greater good. We're not in that situation. We're terrible at that. It's just hard.
How do you think Joe Biden is doing? If you had to grade him on his reaction, his stewardship over the United States dealing with this conflict.
You know, I think they've done a great job of walking this line of supporting the Ukraine without escalating to a point that this could actually turn into a NATO-Russia conflict. And that's not an easy line to walk. What I don't know how to interpret are some of these comments about Putin's a war criminal. Right. He needs to be tried. Are these hard to walk back if Zelensky wants to make a deal? Will we stand in the way of peace? Or is this just posturing? Is this strategic? So I don't know. I think the jury's out. I hope it's careful and considered under difficult circumstances. I think it's a worry if it's off the cuff. And we don't know, right? Because he's good at that. He's been around a long time. And so I think, yeah, we don't know.
He's good at both. He's good at, you know, he's been in foreign policy for forever. He's got more experience than probably anybody. But he's also known to just speak off the cuff and say things that he probably shouldn't say. So we don't know. Have you sent a copy of Why We Fight to the White House?
if I knew the address, I guess I would.
1400 Pennsylvania Avenue. Just
right, exactly.
Joe Biden.
I'm connected with some of the folks within 1 or 2 degrees of separation, and I've been trying to get the book on their desk. And let's hope they read it.
Christopher Blattman. Again, the book is Why We Fight: The Roots of War and the Paths to Peace. Hopefully they'll read The Paths to Peace and we get there. Thank you so much. Thanks for writing this. Thanks for coming on the show. Oh, one more thing I meant to say. Your website is chrisblattman.com, and obviously you're a professor because you basically show how to use this in the classroom, how to teach the book, which is very nice. You give the lesson plans to go ahead and teach it. Who is this for? College students, or would you take it into the high schools?
Oh, I would take it down to that level. I actually had a high school class come by and they'd read it, and they'd read like some early copies and loved it and engaged. Wow. So I'm sure, you know, because that's, you know, it's kind of meant for the general reader. It's sort of supposed to be a way for, there's decades and decades and decades of work on, like, we know why we fight. We know how to stop it. And it's like a secret no one has let the rest of the world into. And so I just boiled down all these decades of work by different people into something that, you know, anybody can understand, including these students. I hope they read it, because one of them will be president in the future. And we'd like them to think that war is actually not the best option.
And some of them could be called up anytime. Yes. Now they are of that age. So, yeah, probably them more than anybody else should read it, because they're the ones who are going to take over. Chris Blattman, thank you so much. It was a fascinating conversation. I really appreciate the work.
No, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Chris Blattman and Why We Fight. Why We Fight. All right, I got to run. I'm going over to the Progressive Democrats of America YouTube channel. I'm going to be on with Harvey Wasserman, Nina Turner, and a cast of thousands, apparently. Bye, everyone. Bye. Got to go.